So I am always very receptive to bad ideas. And it's wild. The views are incredible. You know, you're looking at hundreds of peaks that no one's climbed before. And no one probably ever will. It's just so remote. And there's glaciers everywhere. It's incredible, but all you can think about is getting down. Climbing has taught me, and it has definitely affected other parts of my life, where I learned that taking the risk and trying it, 90% chance I'll fall, but there is that chance that it'll work. And then you just move on to the next move.
Join explorers and travelers on their journeys and discover distant places and fascinating cultures. From the highest peaks and densest jungles into the heart of adventure, this is Unfolding Maps with Eric Lawrence.
Maureen Beck was born without her left hand, but that didn't stop her to start climbing at the age of 12. She did that to prove everyone wrong who thought that this sport, particularly this sport, might really not be for her. And, well, by now she has won multiple titles, amongst them a gold medal at the 2014 Paraclimbing World Championships in Spain, and she has defended that title with a gold medal at the 2016 World Championships in Paris. In 2019, Maureen was named one of National Geographic's Adventurers of the Year. She has also starred in some really, really well-made climbing movies, such as in the 2017 movie Stumped, which has won numerous awards and has toured hundreds of cities all over the world. Moreover, she starred in the 2019 movie Adaptive, in which she went with Jim Ewing, which is a fellow adaptive climber, on her first alpine expedition ever. They went together to the Northwest Territories in Canada's Nahanni National Park, where they attempted the legendary Lotus Flower Tower in the Cirque of the Unclimbables. So, as you can see, a lot of numbers and a lot of achievements. It just means that she really has a lot to share, and I'm really excited to welcome her as my guest today. Have fun with our conversation. Hi, Maureen. Welcome to the podcast, and thank you so much for making the time to do this.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
In an interview a while ago, you described your very first alpine expedition to the so-called Lotus Flower Tower, which is, by the way, considered to be one of the so-called unclimbables, in quotation marks. You described this expedition like this, quote, "If you want to try rock climbing, this is not the story that's going to make you want to do this," unquote. And I'd like to start with this exact story. Would you mind taking us with you? Where is this tower located, and how can I imagine the general environment there, and what does make this tower special in your eyes?
Sure. So the Cirque of the Unclimbables is in northern Canada, kind of right on the edge of the Arctic Circle. So think midsummer, the days are 22 hours, 23 hours long. It's not that cold, like not as cold as you would think, but there's no trees. We're above tree lines. We're at a high altitude. And it's very wet and rainy, and it's a very ancient mountain chain. So while it's granite, it's kind of always falling apart and falling down. So you set up your tent. You actually take a helicopter in, and they drop you off for a month. And then you set up your tents in a tight circle in this beautiful green field called Fairy Meadows. But all around you is this
nice.
It's like very dreamy, except that all around you are these craggy peaks that are just rocketing rock down all day, all night. And so it's never quiet. Like, I guess I imagined being in the middle of nowhere like that as a very quiet, peaceful place. And it's actually very active and loud and destructive because the glaciers further up are moving and melting and rocks are falling there. And it's just, it's a very wild, old, craggy place. It's almost very Lord of the Rings-like kind of. And there typically aren't that many people there because it is so hard to get to. However, the season we were there was about six other teams. They're give or take, people kind of come and go. A lot of people actually take the river to raft in, whereas we took the helicopter. But it is very remote. It's the most remote I've ever been. I've never had that feeling of being dropped off and left. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, there's no cell phone service. We just have a satellite phone to check for weather now and then. And it's lonely, but it's beautiful. It's a very wild place.
why does the Lotus Flower Tower belong to the unclimbables? What makes it so difficult to climb? I imagine, you described the granite that is kind of dissolving due to old age probably, but probably that also should mean that there are a lot of cracks that you can use for climbing, and that technically it should be a little bit easier.
When the region was first surveyed by European settlers, you know, they didn't go up into the mountains. They just looked at it from afar and said, those are unclimbable. No one can ever climb them. And it was about the 60s and 70s, mostly 70s, when people finally got up there and climbed them. And for the most part, the climbs aren't technically difficult, like in the range of crazy hard, muscly climbs. Most of them aren't that hard, but they are exposed. You're thousands of feet up. And while there are cracks, there's also cracks there because rocks are falling off. So oftentimes when you put gear into the mountain to arrest your fall, the gear could end up just pulling out with rotten rock. So even though once it was finally climbed, they realized, oh, these are climbable, not unclimbable, they're still not the most solid of climbing. But from afar, they look impenetrable. When we first got to the meadows, I remember looking, my first view of the lotus flower was actually from our helicopter. And I just thought, oh no, like this is, what am I doing here? I can't do this. Cause I'd never done anything that remote expedition style, let alone that's 2000 feet straight of just vertical rock.
So if you've never done anything like that before, how did it come about that now this was the time for you to try it for the very first time?
So I am always very receptive to bad ideas. I had a friend reach out. He had lost his leg in a climbing accident about 2 years before he reached out to me. And he was always a very strong climber. But once he lost his leg, he realized, life is short. What's some things I want to do that I just keep pushing off? And this is one of those things. It's a classic climb. It's on a lot of people's to-do lists, but it's so remote and difficult to get to. And it takes a month and a half out of your life. So, you know, once you have a job and a family, it's easy to say, oh, I'll do it next year. I'll forget about it. I'll do it later. And he had that, you know, he almost died and he decided, actually, this is important to me. And he reached out to me because he thought it'd be really neat, to do it with another amputee, to do all disabled. And I actually said yes before I really, like, Googled it much.
why did you say yes? Why this urge to jump at this opportunity?
Yeah, so I find that, so I knew it was new and remote. And I find that if I think too hard, I'll find reasons to be afraid and say no. And I think fear is a bad reason to say no to something. And so if I say yes right away, then I have to do it. Like, I've committed to this friend to accompany him. And so it wasn't until a little later when I was researching it that I thought, ooh, this is going to be a big deal.
So if fear is a bad reason to say no, what is a good reason for you to say no to something?
If I had legitimate safety concerns, or, you know, maybe it is technically harder or had skills that I didn't have, or in this case, if I were the stronger climber of the pair, but because my friend Jim is a very strong climber, he's done this style before, I was comfortable with him sort of being the mentor and the leader. And then with him, I was, you know, fully transparent about what my comfort level and experience was. And I kind of gave him a chance to say no to me as well. Mm-hmm. Like, I even told him that, you know, maybe I'm not the best partner for this. But he kept saying yes anyway. He was like, no, you have time to train. I believe in you. We will do this together. So I think if I had a bad partner, that's a good reason to say no. Mm-hmm. I think I thought it was safer than it was. Like, climbing's always a little dangerous. But it's also easy to say, oh, no, that won't happen to me. Or we're going to be on this well-traveled route. It will be clean of rockfall. Once I was there, I realized, oh, no, there's still a lot of rockfall and things like that. But a lot of the hazards in climbing you can manage. So a lot of the fear I have is what I kind of call irrational fear. Because, you know, your brain knows you're not supposed to be 1,000 feet up on a wall. And you're not supposed to be climbing in the rain in the Arctic. So you have to kind of override that irrational fear. And eventually the reasons to say yes were just more powerful than the reasons to say no.
So that's why you did say yes. And of course, that meant that you were now really, in it. You had to make it real. And some of the conditions to make it real meant that you had to prepare quite a bit, right? To train.
Yes.
How did you try to prepare for this challenge?
So I am mostly a competition climber, which is indoors on plastic, or a sport climber, which is outdoors where you have bolts already in the rock. So you just clip your rope to them and don't think too much. I'm not that much of a trad climber, which is when you actually place the protection as you go and remove it. And so I had to do a lot of that. I wanted to be comfortable moving through that high mountain terrain quickly, safely, efficiently, because you are dealing with so much bad weather. It really comes down to efficiency more than actually climbing hard. Because if you can move fast, you can avoid the storms, you can avoid the weather. So there's a lot of focus on that. And Jim and I actually climbed in Las Vegas and Colorado together. So we had two fairly good-sized climbing trips to sort of learn each other's climbing styles so that we could swap positions quickly, we could move quickly. And we even had some long suffer days where we just learned how each other worked when we were stressed and when we were tired. And after all of those, we still liked each other.
Okay, that's a good proof of friendship. Yeah.
So like long days in desert Vegas with no water, we're just like, I'm uncomfortable right now and I'm thirsty and I'm tired, but we're still thinking okay, we're checking each other, so this is good to go. So most of the training wasn't so much physical as it was technical, as it was learning each other's styles.
But you also said in another interview once that it was the first time that working harder and training did not necessarily equal success. Why is that? Where were the limits, the boundaries of training for that project?
Yeah, so typically before this trip, I've always trained for just climbing hard. Yeah. And that's more of a mathematical equation where if you train hard, you'll climb harder.
You know, so very controllable.
Yeah, if you lift more weights, if you eat better, your body will perform better. And so much of the Lotus Flower Tower was mental, was, you know, can you perform under the stress? Can you control and manage your fear while you're up there and not just lose it? The climbing itself was very scary. It was very thin. You were tens, if not dozens of feet in between protective pieces. The pitches are so long that Jim would take off and we wouldn't see each other for 2 hours because it was an entire, you know, 70 meters away. And so that was actually almost impossible to train for. Like I would do some alpine climbs here, but it was just different maybe because you always knew, well, I'm still in Colorado and I'm still 2 hours away from my house. And, you know, I still help is a button away if it happens. And so it's just, I found that it was hard to sort of reproduce, you know, the landscape of up there. And I don't think I realized it till I got there. It just felt different.
You mentioned that probably even more important than the physical preparation is the mental preparation. How do you try to prepare mentally for a challenge like this?
Man, it's kind of almost one of those things where you just have to do it. Like you don't know until you do it. Mm-hmm. So we did the multi-pitch training. I tried to do a bunch of trad, but you just can't really reproduce what it's like to hide in your tent for 2 weeks because it's raining and then be able to brush it off and go climb through the weather window. Like that's just something you do. So I think the mental things, I wouldn't call it training. It was just things I thought through before I left was, I might go up there and it might rain the entire 30 days. We might never touch this tower. So kind of embracing that like ultimate failure before we even went, just figuring out how to be okay with it. And then I also had personal goals that I was like, I'd love to be able to lead half the pitches. I'd love to be able to pull my weight. But if I get there and it's not suited to my style of climbing, I might have to give up and just let Jim do it all. And how can I do that and not feel like a total failure and instead just kind of flip the switch and keep moving on? You know, defining that our ultimate metrics for success would be 1, coming home safely, 2, getting to the top however we can.
And before you could even attempt to get to the top, of course, you had to get to this remote area. And you already mentioned that you went there by helicopter. But yes. I also believe that this was not quite as easy as that sounds.
No.
Sitting in a helicopter and waiting for arrival.
So it was an entire day of, you know, regular commercial flights to get to Whitehorse, Canada. And then from there, it's a 6-hour dirt road drive to the middle of nowhere where a float plane picks you up and flies you to a lodge. And then you sit there and wait for a weather window to then helicopter into the cirque. And if there's bad weather at any step of the way, you're just kind of sat there and waiting. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then finally, of course, you did arrive. You pitched up your tent probably somewhere in the wilderness.
Mm-hmm. And in the best case scenario, it takes 3 days to get there. And it took us about 7.
Why is that? Just because of
bad weather? Bad weather. And actually, it was a terrible wildfire season in Western Canada. Mm-hmm. So all of the helicopters had been requisitioned.
Oh, okay.
So between weather and fires, we just sat there waiting for our ride.
And how was it after this long periods of waiting and transporting and so on to finally see the tower for the first time?
It was intimidating. It was both. It was amazing to finally be, you know, in the Cirque. Like when you're in the lodge or in the hotel room, it doesn't really feel like your trip has started and you're just watching your time tick away. But then once you're there, it's just like such an immediate switch. Like it's so quick. All of a sudden you're there and you're set up and you're in expedition mode. And we had to make a choice pretty quickly because when we arrived, it was okay weather that day, good weather the next day. But then the day after that, a system was moving in. And so we knew we should either attempt it right away or that we would be sitting for a bit. And we decided to wait it out. Mm-hmm. We were pretty tired from just like the emotion of moving, of the transport. You still have to hike a bunch of your gear a little ways from the helicopter spot. And of course, we had like camera equipment and batteries. And so it wasn't a nice light load. And so, and there were six other parties that were going to do it the next day.
Wow. Okay. Many reasons to take a break.
Yeah. So we decided we would hike to the base, maybe climb the first pitch just to touch rock. But that wasn't going to be our go day. And unfortunately, the weather was right on day three. It moved in and we had snow, we had rain, and we had mist and winds, and it was pretty, it almost goes lunar landscape up there when the weather's bad. You're just in your colored tent pod by yourself for 18 hours of the day.
Wow. And how long did you spend like this? How many days before you could actually attempt?
I want to say it was about 9 or 10 days.
Quite a long time.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I found out, this is another thing you don't know until you do it, I'm actually kind of good at that. I could just curl up in my sleeping bag, read a book, nap, come out for lunch, go back to my sleeping bag. I didn't mind it. You know, I wasn't going too stir crazy. We had a couple board games and card games. But no, it was almost, you know, getting into just this rhythm of food, socialize, sleep, read, food. Yeah, I found out I was actually okay with that. I wasn't going crazy. But again, you just feel that clock ticking, 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 and you're thinking, did I just, you know, spend all this money as well as this time out of my life? Like in August in Colorado, it's prime climbing season. Mm-hmm. So did I just completely blow off my summer, let alone all the training I did? That wasn't, you know, my primary focus. So I just waste 6 to 8 months of my life to never touch this tower.
But luckily, that's not exactly what happened. So how did it continue once the weather improved?
We finally got a weather window, and our entire intention was to do the entire tower in a day. It's common to do that now. There is a halfway spot where, you know, I would say not that long ago, but kind of maybe 20 years ago, it was more common to take 2 days. And Jim decided he wanted to do it all in one day. Just move fast, move efficient. And we got up there for a half day and realized we're not that fast or efficient. Mm-hmm. The rock was so crumbly that it was taking us much longer to lead and find protection. Even on the dry days, the bottom half of the tower is just oozing water. So as you stick your hands in the crack, it just drips down your sleeve onto your body. And it was just very, very slow. So we made a call that we would plan on doing it in 2 days. We would get to the Bibby Ledge, spend the night, and then try to get to the summit the next day. So that was the plan, the new plan.
And how did reality hold up to that plan?
Or the other way around? Yeah.
How did the plan hold up to the reality?
Yeah. you know, a lot of things went wrong with this trip, from the weather to not doing it in a day to we ended up not even be able to free climb it. Some parts we ended up having to pull in our own gear because the rock was just so wet. Mm-hmm. And I'd never really aid climbed before. So here I am in the Arctic Circle with my partner yelling me instructions how to do it, you know, 600 feet off the ground.
Yeah.
And I always tell people the more that went wrong with this trip, the kind of more I learned, because it is so new for me. So the first time I ever spent the night on a big wall was this trip. And we weren't supposed to.
Yeah.
And so the first day was very wet, very loose. Another party was ahead of us and very slow and kicking rocks down on us the entire day. So we ended up getting to the ledge at about 11 o'clock at night. So quite late, much later than we wanted. And that first day, I would say I was not having fun. Mm-hmm. You know, we were wet, we were cold. It was very loose rock and it was lonely. Like I said earlier, Jim would just be gone for an hour and a half, and I would climb up to him. We'd take 10 minutes to swap gear, and then he would disappear again. So even though you have a partner, I feel like I never saw him. And so there was a couple moments on day one where I was just cold and wet and listening to the rock fall and the glaciers collapse. I just stare into the distance and think, why am I here?
It sounds a bit bleak, I have to say.
I was just like, why am I here? This is not fun. Rock climbing is supposed to be fun. But then we got to the ledge, and the other team we were with, you know, had dinner ready for us. And for all the awful weather that we had, that night was warm and clear and windless, and we got early northern lights coming down.
Wow.
So we just slept in the open and, you know, the green dancing lights across the sky. And that's when I thought, okay, reset. Mm-hmm. This is a good thing. Like, this is good. I think we're going to do it. Because the forecast for the next day was the best weather the entire month.
The ledge is basically the camp that you set up in the face of the mountain.
Yes. So it's almost exactly halfway up. Yeah. And it's about the size of a school bus. So it's maybe...
Okay. So like a pretty big step.
So it's like maybe 3 meters deep and 15 meters wide. So you're tied in the whole time, but you can really move around and sleep flat.
Okay. So that gave you the opportunity to re-energize and to get into a different mindset and, approach the second day with a different attitude, hopefully.
Yeah. And that's kind of what we needed, except when I woke up the next morning, Jim realized he was sick. He had some kind of stomach bug. And we had all had it throughout the trip. But we had all had it and gotten over it. And then Jim's decided to hit on day two. And he was vomiting. He was feverish. And I was just like, I think we should turn around, Jim. You're like, you're sick. We shouldn't climb. But to him, you know, he had dreamt of this climb for 20 plus years. And I think he knew that this was the only chance he would ever have to do it. Whereas who knew? Maybe I could go back one day, but he was just like, this is my one shot and the weather's amazing. So I'm just going to do it. And so we set off with him. Very sick, and with me not being able to do any of the leading, as in the pictures, the cracks look deep enough to like shove my left arm in, and in reality, they weren't. So he had to lead everything, and I just was the best support I could be, which was forcing him to eat snacks and forcing him to drink water.
But it's still a pity for him, right? I mean, probably it was still very meaningful, and especially now remembering this trip. But in the moment, it was probably very hard for him to enjoy any of it in a second day.
Yeah, I think, you know. And he's even gotten stronger since then. He was so fresh from his amputation, you know, and when you have that happen, you fall out of shape for sure. You spend a lot of time sitting around. And, you know, the gym today, I think if he were healthy and not sick, he would be able to climb the whole thing in a day. And so for him, when we did this trip, though, you know, he was sick. He was still not quite in shape. And so the mental fortitude he had to just not turn around. And I think we kept looking at each other, daring the other person with our eyes to say, let's turn around. But neither of us would do it. And I think that's why we're such good partners, because we just really don't let each other quit.
So how was it after all these struggles to finally reach the summit?
You're so tired when you get up there. It's kind of anticlimactic. It's finally quiet because you're above all the rock fall. But there's something about you that, you know, there's no rock band at the top or there's no confetti. You're just there. And it's wild. The views are incredible. You know, you're looking at hundreds of peaks that no one's climbed before and no one probably ever will. It's just so remote. And it's wild and there's glaciers everywhere. And it's incredible. But all you can think about is getting down. Like you're just ready to turn right around and get off, because you have 2,000 feet of rock to rappel before you, and then an hour and a half hike before you get back to your tent. So it's, I'm a little sad because I was so tired. Like, we actually didn't even walk up to the true summit because you have to actually unrope and scramble. And I thought, I am just so tired. If I unrope, I'm going to fall off this mountain. Like, I cannot trust myself. No. And I regret that now. But at the time, I was like, I don't care about the real summit. Like, get me off. I'm hungry. I'm thirsty. We're done. But you definitely have this feeling like this. You don't have success yet when you're at the top. Like, it really hits you that there's still a lot of work to do to get back.
That's always
down.
The way back, right? I mean, that's true for all the major summits. And most accidents also actually happen.
It's also true that the way down is the most dangerous. Like, the most close calls or near mistakes I made in the entire trip were 100% on the way down. But we did get down, so...
But I also have to say, I mean, I quoted you with your phrase, if you want to try rock climbing, this is not the story that's going to make you want to do. I kind of understand why you said that now. But on the other hand, I also feel that it in some ways is exactly the story that would at least animate someone like you to like the idea to tackle such an adventure.
It's exactly that. It was an adventure. It's not, you know, it's not just going out to my local crag after work and getting some sunny laps. And it's like a different type of rock climbing for sure. But yeah, I say that because like I'll show the film about it or I'll tell stories about it. And it makes it sound like all rock climbing is wet and miserable and loose and dangerous. Yeah. And it's not. It's not. But, you know, I think because it was so miserable, it makes it a better story. No one really cares to tell stories about the easy things. Mm-hmm. And I also agreed to this trip because it wasn't a style I had done before. Not the expedition. I've never been away from home for a month, my family. And I said, I will do this so I can say I've tried it and I'll probably hate it, but at least I can say I tried. And instead, despite all reason and how terrible it was, as soon as we were back in Whitehorse on our flights home, I was just like, okay, what's next? Like, where should we go next? Patagonia? The Bugaboos? Like, what's next?
Yeah, that's the typical reaction, right? The memory of the pain and all the misery pretty quickly subsides.
Gone.
And then you're just like, wow, that was awesome.
And it also empowers you to know, like, you did get through that, like, you kind of forget about the hard parts and the parts where you almost cried. But you remember you were there and that you did get through them. And so since then, every time I've been like mentally collapsing, I'm like, no, you can do this. You have done this. So just power through. So that trip going forward has helped me immensely. Like that trip was almost training for the next trip and the next trip. So you're always training for the next one.
So it really taught you something about your own mental resilience, basically.
Yeah. I think it taught me I was stronger than I thought I was.
Yeah. Does that also help you in your other styles of climbing? Like if you're, for example, in a climbing gym to push yourself even further?
It's definitely helped me manage fear. Mm-hmm. You know, like what could be more scary than what we did than being up there alone with the mountain collapsing around you? You know, it makes any day at the climbing gym just feel super casual. And, you know, it does make me appreciate the style of climbing that you can just get better at by doing it more and practicing it. Whereas, like, it's almost impossible to practice for the big expeditions. You just have to do them and kind of take the punches as they come and things don't go to plan. I don't think you could execute a month-long trip like that and have everything go right.
So that Lodos climb was Jim's big dream?
Yes.
Do you yourself have a big dream like that, that you one day would like to realize?
You know, I don't think of it as a single peak. Like there's just, I think there's just too many climbs in the world, too many mountains in the world. But I would like to, I think of it as regions. Like I would love to spend time in the Bugaboos in Canada. I would love to go to Patagonia. And actually a good friend of mine who's also a leg amputee, he wants to do an all disabled ascent of Fitzroy in Patagonia.
Wow.
And I'm like that's a big peak that's a fun goal. Yeah. You know, before COVID happened, I was hoping to spend a whole month in the summer in Chamonix doing some of the big peaks there. So it's interesting. My dreams have shifted more towards the alpine, less the sport climbing that I've usually loved. Because I feel like, oh, I can do that whenever, but I have to plan and want the alpine trips. Like that takes intent.
So Jim actually had quite a big impact on you in that regard.
He did. And actually, I'm meeting him in 2 weeks in Las Vegas again to do some more big walls.
Very
so
nice,
at the end of all of this, we were still really good friends. And and I don't think he'll admit it, but he is such a mentor to me. You know, he's 30 years older than me and has been climbing since the 80s, since before I was born. And that he takes time to hang out with me means a lot and teach me what he's learned.
Great. I would like to talk a little bit about how it all started for you, if you wouldn't mind. And on your website, I found a little but a pretty meaningful story about you, about you, your mother, and a steak.
Ah, that story.
So you know what I'm referring to.
Yeah.
Would you mind telling us the story?
Sure. So I was actually born without my hand. So I feel like I haven't really overcome any hardship because it's just all I've ever known.
No.
But my parents always raised me to, you know, not let that be an excuse, to not let that be a reason to not try something, even when it annoyed me. So they taught me how to tie my shoes before I went to school. So that's actually very advanced for my age, because they're so worried that I wouldn't be able to do it without help, and that would set the tone with my teachers and friends for the rest of my schooling. So before I went to school, they made sure I knew how to tie my own shoes. And then, yeah, they would also make me, you know, cut my own steak, which is really hard with one hand. And I remember my mother said, well, what are you going to do when you move out? Are you just going to meet some guy to do it for you? And the joke's on them, because I did. I started dating my husband my first year of university. So to this day, he still cuts my meat. So maybe it's more of a lesson of when it's okay to ask for help, because for a very long time, I refused to ever ask for help for anything.
No.
And then, you know, I played all the usual sports like soccer and did track and field, but I went to a very cool Girl Scout camp that had actual rocks to climb, like not just a plywood wall as you usually think of for summer camps. It was these giant glacial erratic granite boulders. And that really stuck with me, because every other activity at camp, from like archery to canoeing, we could like use my prosthetic and figure out a way to do it. But with rock climbing, the counselor said, oh, you probably can't do this. You can just sit this out. And I was 12 or 13. And that just enraged me. I was like, no. You can't tell me what to do. So I kind of did it. I don't think I did it well. I don't even know if I made it to the top, but I was kind of just like, screw you, watch me. And I felt so cool doing it that I kept going back to it. And
the interesting thing for me is that you also applied this kind of behavior in areas that you actually didn't have any disadvantages, such as, for example, you mentioned that you also played soccer, which, of course, the legs are most important
for. You would think,
for.
Except yes. I insisted on being the goalie.
Exactly. So explain that to me.
I don't know. I guess because I hated running. Yeah. And I thought the goalie doesn't have to run that much.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. I wish I could tell you why that seemed like a good idea at the time. But
do you think it was a purposeful rejection of either the disabled community or being part or being considered as part of that community?
Yeah, and I think I also just liked how physical that was, like how I could throw myself on the ground and throw my body in front of this ball. And it might have been the running, though, to be honest.
Okay.
But no, I always get... I still do. I always like proving people wrong and doing things I'm not supposed to do.
Do you think that is a result in part of your parents' parenting style?
How
Oh, sure. They taught you to be independent?
Yeah, absolutely. And they, you know, even if it was annoying at the time, the way they would force me to do things, and they wouldn't like overly celebrate if I did do something. They were just like, well, we knew you could do it. And so I guess not only has my attitude been to prove people wrong, but then when people are surprised or they're like, oh, wow, it's so inspiring. I'm like, well, why? I knew I could do it. Like, that's not that surprising.
Do you think it was a conscious decision on their part to treat you like that and to not make a big fuss of
it?
To help you to not make a big fuss of it? Or
mm-hmm. Yeah. Because they didn't know I wasn't going to have a hand. Like, it was 1986. The ultrasounds weren't that good. They had no idea there's anything wrong with me until I popped out. And so right then and there in that room, I think they decided, whatever, we're just going to roll with it. Like, we're not going to take time to complain about this or think about what could go wrong. We're just going to do it. Which now that I say that out loud, it's kind of how I approach climbing. Like, let's just not think about what could go wrong. Let's just say yes. So maybe they did pass on more than I think they did.
So, but it shows that the approach definitely worked. Mm-hmm. You are an absolute yes-sayer. You are a doer. You are always setting out to prove people who doubt you wrong. Mm-hmm. Was that, do you think, always driven for you predominantly by the inner urge that you wanted to prove it to yourself? Or was there also the factor that you really needed to prove it to them to be able to feel more complete, for lack of a better phrase?
I think it's a proving to them. I don't know if I've just gotten lucky or if I'm too confident, but I feel like I have a history of when I want to do something, I know I can do it. And I decide early on, I'm going to do that.
No.
So it's probably been more outward. And I think it's good to have people doubt me, or at least I feed off of it. Because when someone doubts me, then I set out to prove them wrong, or I use that as motivation to try harder. If everybody thought, oh yeah, you can do that, I'd be like, yep, probably. Let's just go back to knitting. I don't know. So I think, you know, doing it to prove people wrong might not be the quote unquote healthiest motivation, but it works for me. I find it quite motivating.
And you also mentioned in passing that this, besides many other things, of course, led to you discovering your passion for climbing.
Yeah.
And I believe that a Paradox Sports was quite essential in that development, wasn't
yes.
it?
Well, they were great too. So up until like all through university, I didn't really consider myself disabled. I did not identify with the disabled community. When I was young, my parents maybe put me in a camp or two of like, you know, basketball for kids with disabilities, and I hated it because I found that it was more the counselors than the other kids, but they gave us excuses. You know, they patted us on the back for not doing anything special. And I just didn't like that attitude. And I just thought that must be everybody with a disability. That must be the whole community. They're lame. I want nothing to do with that. And then I started ice climbing, and Paradox Sports reached out and said, hey, we've seen your posts on the internet. We do an adaptive ice climbing festival. We think you should come. And I said, why not? I'm new to ice climbing. This sounds cool. It's in Colorado. I live in Vermont. Like, it'll be a chance to get to the big mountains. And I went to this event, and these people had no excuses. These people that couldn't use their legs were rappelling into icy gorges and like using crampons on their butt to climb out. You know, blind guys were just punching the ice with their tools. And at the end of the day, they all went out to the bars and partied harder than anybody I'd ever met in college. And I thought, okay, these people are cool. Like, they're not like defined by their disability, or they're not looking for pity. Like, they're out to climb and excel as hard as they can, you know, not even despite their disabilities, but just to spite them, just to prove it wrong. And that was when I realized it's okay to have a disability. Like, it's okay. It's who I am.
Nowadays, when you are climbing in climbing gyms, you mentioned mm-hmm. that this is primarily what you are doing. Do you still experience or observe uncertainties regarding the training or the contact with adaptive sports people? Or is that not really an issue anymore nowadays?
It certainly is an issue. It's not an issue for me personally, because I am well enough known in the climbing community that for the most part, I can walk into any climbing gym in the States and people be like, oh, you're that girl from the movie. You know, they might not know my name, but you're that girl. Yeah. And so people, I think, or they see like I'm a professional athlete and they're just like, oh, she knows what she's doing. You know, no. They don't give me a hard time. But I hear stories all the time of someone who's not well known or who's a beginner climber who has a disability, and the staff in the gym don't know how to help them or say, well, you can't belay or you can't do this. So a lot of the work that I do now through Paradox is educating gym employees and how to, you know, be ready for anybody who might come in that door, whether they're walking, whether they're in a wheelchair, whether they're blind, like really be ready to help them excel as an independent climber. And I always harp on independence. For the longest time, I thought I couldn't belay a leader, and it just took practice. And until I could do that, I wasn't like a full partner, right? Like, I always needed another person to belay the other person. This was part three. Yeah. And when I gained that independence, I thought, wow, now I'm a real rock climber. Like, I can just go out with my partner and I'm a real climber now. And that light bulb is something that 99% of people with disabilities can have. You know, it might just take some creative thinking and some technical practice, but there's no reason someone with a disability can't also be an independent rock climber. And so I spend a lot of time, you know, on the phone with Jim saying, you know, no, you have to like teach this person, or this person can do it. Like, you can't just decide because they don't fit in this box of how to do something that they can't do it.
So how does this technique of climbing look for you? Do you use any kind of aids, or which extra tasks do you have to master when climbing because you are missing a hand?
So belaying, it turns out, is the same as everybody else. I just grab the top rope with my elbow and yeah. hold the device in my hand. So I have like 1.5 hands technically. Mm-hmm. Where I do often ask for help is if we are maybe multi-pitching or something, and I'm trying to get into my anchor while grabbing something else. And so sometimes I'll just have to have my partner, you know, put me in or untie me from something or grab something for me. I don't use any prosthetics anymore. Mm-hmm. And I like to tell people that because I think there's a lot of emphasis in our culture with like fancy $50,000 prosthetics. Like, oh, in order to run, you need an $80,000 running blade. In order to play violin, you need a fancy hand that's $100,000. And with climbing, I find that you really, some of those things are neat, but you don't need those things to rock climb. Like, rock climb at its most simple form is just your body as it exists on the rock or in the gym. So I like to show people that, you know, there isn't a lot of, oftentimes there's not a lot of specialty needed to just go to the climbing gym and rock climb. It's a very simple sport. And I have lots of friends who, you know, play wheelchair tennis or do adaptive skiing, and they need the specialized wheelchairs or they need specialized skis. And they say for them, climbing is incredible because they don't need adaptations. They just do it.
Climbing is amazing in that sense. And climbing is also, at least that's what you once said, is a puzzle. You said climbing is not hard because one wasn't strong enough. It's hard because it is a puzzle. Would you explain that?
Yeah. You know, even the hardest climbers in the world, I feel like when they get to the bottom of a very hard climb, odds are they're physically already able to do it. You know, I'm sure like Adam Ondra has his crazy finger stuff, but generally folks have within them what it takes to get to the top. Physically, it's the mental aspect of how do you move when, where do you breathe, where do you rest? And so I find that so much more compelling than just going to do more pull-ups to get stronger. Very rarely when I do a project or a hard climb, do I find that just training physically gets me there. Mm-hmm. It's usually unlocking a piece of information that all of a sudden makes it go. And you're surprised. And sometimes you're mad because you're thinking, why didn't I figure this out 30 tries ago? But I just find that more interesting than just brute force. Because if climbing were all about brute force, I would just do CrossFit or lift weights or something, you know, just go for like 5 more pounds on the deadlift. But it's the puzzle that keeps me around.
What do you think, which kind of qualities do you need to be successful in that kind of puzzle?
I think you need to be willing to fail. Mm-hmm. You know, there's failure on the big expedition, that kind of stuff. But then there's the day-to-day. Climbing's a lot like skiing, where if you're not falling, you're not trying hard. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can only figure out the puzzle if you do it wrong. So it's mm-hmm. only when you fall that you're learning. If you're not falling, you know, you're probably not having to solve the puzzle. It's probably too easy for you. And, you know, there's times and places for that style. But when it comes to trying hard, you know, climbing has taught me, and it has definitely affected other parts of my life, where I learned that taking the risk and trying it, you know, 90% chance I'll fall, but there is that chance that it'll work. And then you just move on to the next move.
Do you ever struggle with that yourself? Like if you fall again and again, over and over again at the same place, just not being able to push past this particular obstacle, how do you keep yourself trying one more time?
It's probably also a great lesson in learning when it's okay to give up. As a society, it's like, mm-hmm. never give up, never
exactly.
surrender.
Yeah.
But climbing, it's everybody's shaped different. The rock doesn't care that I'm 5'6" one-handed, like the rock is the rock. And mm-hmm. so with grades too, there's very, very hard grades that I find easy. And just this past weekend, I was doing a climb in the desert, and it was a relatively easy pitch, and I just couldn't do one move. I just couldn't make this one reach, and I had to quit and let my partner lead the pitch instead. So I had the safety of the top rope, and I was almost in tears. I was like, I can't, I'm a professional and I can't do this easy climb. So it's really good at keeping your ego in check, I think, because, mm-hmm. you know, you can have your chest all puffed up, like, this is an easy climb, I'll do it. And then the rock is like, no. Today's not your day. So it's a good lesson in when to give up, both mentally as well as a safety thing. Like if I had tried that move and I didn't make it, I was looking at a very nasty fall. Mm. So it's learning to learn through failure as well as learning when to say, this isn't the one for me, and kind of walking away sometimes.
Learning through failure is maybe not the right sentence for my next question or the next right bridge. But maybe what you said before, keeping your ego in balance.
Yeah.
I'm referring to the very beginning of your career in competitive sports. You at one point decided that you were willing and interested in participating in tournaments and competitions. What attracted you to that in general back then?
I've always been competitive. Like I've always done the sports and stuff.
Yeah.
And climbing's cool because you're kind of competing against yourself, or maybe it's more like a race where everybody has the same track, but whether you have a good day or a bad day is kind of up to you. So even though, you know, there's other women I'm competing against, at the end of the day, it's just about how good I can do. But the main thing about competing for me was it was paraclimbing. For the first time, I was in a room of other climbers with disabilities who've made a decision. They want to train. They want to be the best they can be. And the thing is, when you're abnormal like me, if you put me in a room with other abnormal people, all of a sudden everyone's normal because mm-hmm. you're all weird. There's something wrong with each of you. So like no one stands out anymore. And so I think I got into competition as much for that community as the chance to prove how much I could do. And paraclimbing's hard. Like, they set the one route, and whether you're missing a right hand or a left hand, like, that's it. So paraclimbing maybe is not ever going to be the best judge of who's the best climber, but it still inspires me to try my hardest and train and teach others too.
Yeah.
Now that there's competitive paraclimbing, it's a nice entry point for people who might want to rock climb. Like, they have a goal now. They can start just casually, but they see someone like me who's competing and saying, well, maybe if I train really hard, I can do that too.
Yeah. I found it very interesting to read when I read up your story. Well, of course, in the very first competitions, you didn't win a medal or anything. It takes time. You need to learn and to improve. I remember reading about one of the early competitions in Atlanta. I think it was the first ever adaptive climbing national
championship. My first competition, I got gold because I was the only person.
So that was your first medal. So how did that make you feel?
You know, it was still new, so it felt fine. I definitely did. Again, it was an ego thing where I didn't want to brag about it because I was like, I felt like a fraud. I was one of one. But then other people would say, but you still showed up, and other people didn't. So you did earn something. But it still wasn't the best. Like, I've always told people I would rather be 10th out of 50 than first out of 10.
No.
But the sport was brand new. That was the first ever national championships in the U.S. And I think the first ever international comps had only been a few years before.
How did that landscape change by today?
It's changed quite a bit. So that first year, just in the U.S., I think there were something like 30 competitors. And then our last nationals in 2019, there was almost 100. Internationally, my first world championships in 2014, we brought 15 athletes. And last year to France national world championships, we brought almost 40. There's more countries now. My own category has gone from 2 to 9, I think, which is, it's not huge, but it's still like a big growth. The last world championships, there were over 150 athletes. Like, think of that, 150 people with disabilities who decide that rock climbing is their passion enough to travel around the world to compete. Like, it's pretty wild.
It's really impressive, especially because, rock climbing is, of course, it's about sports. It's about the challenge. It's about you and the rock or the climbing wall in whatever case it is. But it's also about discomfort, right? I mean, climbing, I think that's also something that you said once. Climbing is really about your own discomfort and facing that voluntarily. How big a factor is that for you to be able and to be pushed to face this discomfort again and again?
Yeah, that's something that competition helps with, you know. It's easy to get lazy or complacent in training, and like, we call it your try hard. Like, it's hard to turn on your try hard every single day, and you're not supposed to. But something about the atmosphere of competition, you don't just turn on your try hard, you blow through it. Like, when you hear the crowd and the lights are on you and you hear the announcer, it's almost an out of body experience. And when you're doing well, so my last world championships, I had a hunch I wasn't going to win because there's this French girl who's amazingly strong, but I had trained the hardest of my life. I was currently injured, but thought I could climb through it. And for finals, it was an out-of-body experience, and I didn't know what was going on. All of a sudden, I was still on the wall, and I was still pulling, and I was just, like, ripping the holds off is what it felt like. And that's something you can't get anywhere else. There's no outdoor climb, really, that I've had yet that simulates that. And that's kind of what keeps me hooked on competitions. And it's that feeling of when you lower off the wall, when you know that was the best you could have possibly done. Like, you had nothing left more to give. And I remember I was just crying because I was just like, that was it. That was the best I could do. And my coach was like, who are you? I've never seen you climb like that. So if that was my last competition, I'm okay with that.
So probably it didn't even matter anymore to you who won which medal.
Yeah, at that point, I had no regrets. And I always struggle with regrets with competitions because, like, it's not like an outdoor project where you can always come back next season. A competition is that date. Like, you have one shot.
Yeah.
And I always, when it comes time, I'm like, oh, I shouldn't have skipped those workouts, or I should have done this differently. I always have regret and doubt. And that last competition, I was like, that's it. That is the best. Like, I could not have done any better. And that's a cool feeling that I think a lot of people don't get to have.
the ability to overcome discomfort, the ability also to face your own fears. I mean, you mentioned in passing earlier on that you're also a little bit afraid of heights, which is probably a challenge.
I think everyone should be. Yeah. If a climber always ever tells me, oh, I'm not afraid of heights, I probably won't climb with them because they might be reckless or something.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah. So is this ability to deal with your fears and to face discomforting situations, does this ability also ever help you in everyday life when you're not climbing? For example, I don't know, dealing with a pandemic right now, which is a challenge in different ways to all of us.
I think maybe it's not unique to climbing. Maybe it's just adventures in the outdoors where you do suffer a little bit. Yeah. And I think the older you get, the more you realize, like, I'm not dead yet. Like, I still had a little bit of fun. And I think it lets you find the joy in the suffering. You know, so for the pandemic, like, yes, we were on lockdown for many, many weeks and couldn't leave the house. And so we found joy in baking bread instead. And we found joy in playing video games with the roommates. And then just like climbing, you know, on that whole miserable rainy trip, like, I found joy in learning how to play cribbage for the first time with my partners. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a lot of finding joy through that suffering and through the failure, and choosing to learn rather than just choosing to remember the bad parts.
So was it that easy for you to, when we talk about the lockdown, to let go of climbing for a couple of weeks? Because I could have imagined that it is obviously a really essential part of who you are and what you do.
The climbing community here got really strange where, like, publicly, you know, they didn't want you, like legally, I could go climb, but, you know, as a community, we decided, hey, it's not cool to go climb because not only could you spread the disease, but if you got hurt, then you're taking those resources from, you know, not like getting hurt's pretty rare, but like the odds are, you know, if it did happen, it's just a bad look.
Yeah.
And it was really hard sitting, you know, here at my desk in my house, knowing that other people were just like enjoying empty crags because they didn't care.
Yeah.
But culturally, like, our community decided, especially as a public figure, like, no climbing.
Hmm.
So we trail ran instead, which is somewhat ironic because I've definitely come more close to injury running in the woods than I ever have climbing. It was hard, but at the same time, I think it was also, this whole pandemic was a rest between, like, physically my body from just, like, not climbing, as well as mentally, like, being a professional athlete. In 2019, I think I took something like 20 plus flights to speaking events, to competitions, to climbing trips, to clinics. Like, it was go, 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 go. And to have something like the pandemic force me to stop and kind of enjoy my own backyard again, that's something I'm grateful for.
What would you yourself consider as your greatest success so far when you look back?
I think I'm doing a good job of putting myself out of business. And that is, there are more strong disabled climbers coming up behind me.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not I'm their role model, whether or not they're following my lead, I really hope that I always tell people, like, if in 15 years I'm like the least interesting person ever because there's so many other people with disabilities doing rad things, that's good. I'll happily retire and just not be needed anymore.
How do you deal with this? I don't know if it's attention, but it's at least the situation that you, of course, want to be and are primarily recognized as a mountain climber for your skill, for what you have been able to do. And you don't want to be like seen through the lens of disability primarily.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, that is also where you have a pretty big and meaningful impact. For example, you used the word yourself. It is what you are and who you are. You are a role model to many people. So it's also a very essential part of your work. How do you think about these two sides of the coin?
It's hard. Like, for me to be a professional athlete in the traditional sense is difficult because I'm on these teams with people that climb 514 or climbed Everest. And I mean, I guess I could climb Everest, but I'll probably never climb 514. It's just, you know, again, recognizing what's probably impossible. And so I guess I get some kind of imposter syndrome. Like, why am I here? Like, what's my contribution? But when I get the email or the message from someone that's like, I have a good friend now, and before we were good friends, she was thinking about ice climbing and just assumed she couldn't do it until she saw a photo of me, or a friend sent her a photo of me with an ice axe prosthetic climbing. And now she's like the best one-handed ice climber around. And so I feel like that kind of gives me the reason why. Like, I personally didn't need to see someone like me to try something new. In fact, I found that kind of the appeal of like just being the first. But there are lots of people out there who don't know what's possible until they see it. So if I can encourage someone to get uncomfortable and at least try climbing, it's okay if climbing's not the thing. But I think what's important is that you do find your passion and you do find the thing that you're dedicated to. And if climbing's just a stepping stone on the way to find out that your passion's actually water skiing, that's fine. Yeah. But
I think it's an example that you're setting. It doesn't matter what you do, right? It's just an example for not being put off by seemingly some obstacle that is
And maybe that's the lesson too. Like don't wait for someone else to be the first. Like, don't be afraid to be the first yourself.
Hmm. What did it mean to you to be chosen as one of the National Geographic's Adventurers of the Year a while ago?
I mean, I thought they had the wrong number at first. Because, you know, when I think of adventure, I think like polar explorers and stuff like that. And, you know, I think like the Lotus Flower Tower trip, like that was huge for me personally. But at the end of the day, it's just rock climbing. So sometimes I struggle with like rock climbing. It's a silly sport. It's just a sport. I'm not saving the world every time I go climbing. Why is that special? But it was pretty wild. And I think it gave kind of maybe like more people than I could have ever reached before. It helped tell my story. But it's just, I guess it never really sunk in because I never thought it was possible for me to be a national, like, you know, just like an average kid, just rock climbing for fun. So I think maybe it just kind of helped my confidence a little bit. Like, oh, maybe I am doing something kind of special, not just being a climbing bum. But it was, you know, obviously a huge honor. And yeah, it's still hard to articulate like what it means. Cause it's, still, I guess even 2 years later, I'm like kind of in disbelief.
How did your parents react to it? Are they
so it's funny,
healthy
like
and around?
Yeah, they are. I'm sure they thought climbing was just a thing I would grow out of. And then when I didn't, they're like, oh, it's dangerous. You shouldn't do that. And I said, I'm going to do it. Like the only piece of climbing gear they've ever bought me was a helmet.
that is funny.
Which is very parental. Yeah. And between some of my films coming out and being able to like go part-time at my job because I had enough athlete stuff going on.
Yeah.
National Geographic, I think, was good for them because they knew what it meant. Like, they're not climbers. They don't know what other stuff means or, like, what the competitions are. They're just like, that's great, honey. But National Geographic, that's, like, they're like, oh, our friends know what this means. Like, we can show this to, like, grandma. And they know what it means. So it translated what I do into more of a universal language. They're very adorable. They're very proud. They're still like, I don't know what you do. I don't know what it means, but I'm proud of you.
That is very cute and very special. And it's also nice to see where their encouragement, what it led to eventually.
I think they maybe regret it when I started climbing. I think they thought, oh, maybe we encouraged her too much.
So what's your next goal? What are you going to be up to once we can roam about and roam freely a bit more than we are able to do today?
Yeah, the Lotus Flower trip definitely gave me an appetite for big and bold. Like, of course, I still want to do hard sport climbs whenever I can because it's fun. But when it comes time to actually, you know, planning. So I loved the whole part of it. I loved the menu planning. I loved the packing lists, like the idea of expeditions. I'm like, oh, I like that a lot. Yeah. You know, it's kind of hard to picture a post-pandemic world. Like, it's been long enough that I just do things within driving distance that I'm like, I haven't even thought about Europe or South America or like things that
makes
used
sense,
to be.
I think.
I can't plan. So that's kind of been another fun thing with the pandemic is it's forced me to stay relatively local. Things that I have been skipping in favor of exotic locales. I'm like discovering places close to home. So for now, more of that, but I do really like the idea of more expeditions, whether it's, you know, the Bugaboos are a relatively simple expedition for us, all the way to Patagonia, which is definitely a more complex months long, possibly, time away from home.
Where can we best follow what becomes of these ideas?
Probably. I share everything on Instagram, even, you know, my dogs and my chickens and stuff like that.
Like, okay, so if we want to find out about updates with regard to your chicken,
yes,
Instagram is the place to go.
It is, yeah. And my website, probably. But I think we have another year of like casual domestic climbing.
Yeah, I guess.
And then I'm really hoping for 2022, that's you know, I'm trying to retire from competition, but since they're all canceled last year, I'm like, oh, I need one more year. but hopefully soon I'll be retired from competition. I'll still be proactive in promoting it and recruiting and training. Maybe I'll move into a coach role, but I'd like to focus my own training on those sort of bigger, big mountain objectives.
Great. I will definitely follow very closely what you're up to, and I will link to Instagram and your website, of course, in the show notes. And for now, I thank you very much for this conversation. It was really a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, really fun. I love reminiscing about awful times.
Exactly, especially in the warm coziness of the apartment.
It just makes it so much better. I'm warm.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.